Good morning. It is 11 a.m. and you're tuned in to CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and this is Kingston Currents. CFRC's news programming is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and the screening room at screeningroomkingston.com. To start us off, we're going to dive right into some highlights from Council this week. After a long discussion at their June 17th meeting, Council ultimately voted to rename Indian Road. Indian Road runs through a residential community located in Strathcona Park with approximately 62 households. The motion claims the name is in violation of the Civic Addressing and Road Naming Bylaw, which prohibits names that are discriminatory, offensive, or derogatory. The motion was put forward by Councillor Gregory Ridge, prompted by a request from Indian Road resident Daniel Shipp. Shipp, who has lived on the street for nearly a decade, addressed Council before their discussion.
In my opinion, the street name is not only outdated, it's offensive and derogatory. Due to its complex and often paternalistic colonial history, is very much out of step with our municipal street naming policy.
Brandon Miracle, executive director of Kingston Native Center and Language Nest, an organization that was consulted by Councillor Ridge, also spoke before council.
Anything that exists in culture and society is something that we interact with, whether Indigenous or not. I think, like I mentioned previous, Indian is a complicated one. And when you see that on a road sign, you're met with your entire context as you go into that. That could be that it's the legal term. That could be that you're excited because you use that language, that term as a reclaimed word within community. Or, like I said, it could be a term of pain. Representing a community within Kingston from the Kingston Native Center and Language Nest, all those perspectives are seen. And so it's hard to... What I'm really excited about is the consultation process.
Councillor Ridge introduced the motion, leading with the results of his discussions with several local Indigenous organizations and Indian Road residents, and clarifying the intention of the change.
There are differing opinions on this matter, but the overwhelming majority of those who I had the honor of listening to were in favor and in support of this change. We must also be careful to continue listening and to continue to be supportive as we move forward. Finally, I want to mention something. This motion is not the result of liberal guilt, nor is it the result of wokeness. This motion is not intended to open a larger debate about naming public spaces, but instead to point to a singular matter that requires addressing. To the people who are concerned that we're trying to change history, we can't. Nobody can change history. But we can and must try to make today and tomorrow better for everybody in our community.
Strathcona Councillor Jeff McLaren, however, represented a different perspective. McLaren argued that the people who developed the area decades ago chose the name to recognize the contributions of Indigenous people in Canada, pointing to several other streets in the neighborhood referencing Indigenous history and culture, including Arrowhead Place and Mohawk Place. He also argued that the city has not done enough consultation on the matter and should take a step back before deciding if the name should be changed. At the start of the meeting, he presented a petition started by a resident against changing the name, which garnered 40 signatures from residents of the street. McLaren suggested 3 amendments to the motion.
So, this motion is before us now, even though I had hoped it would not be. And it is possible to make this supportable. There just are a few small changes that need to be made, I think, that would be more respectful and more in line with true reconciliation.
The first 2 amendments, which passed unanimously, were to consult a list of local Indigenous groups and First Nations with a connection to the area on the matter, and to ensure that the history behind Indian Road be preserved and commemorated in some way. However, his 3rd amendment, suggesting they step back to consult further on whether the name should be changed at all, sparked more debate.
We cannot presume to know the answer to consultations before we do the consultation. This motion as written presumes that we're going to change the name because certain people that we've talked to already have said so. Perhaps the frame was correct, perhaps the frame was wrong. I don't know. But the consultation needs to be wide and far apart. If it comes back, having done that, that the majority want this changed, I will support that. but I support that theory that nothing about us without us should be first and primary. This is actually, in fact, how you build trust.
Councillor Connie Glenn supported the amendment.
Councillor Ridge has gone and talked to some people. Councillor McLaren has gone and talked to some people. I've heard some things, you've heard some things. So as we make this kind of a decision, because of the cultural impact, because of the sensitivity around it, I think maybe taking a step back to allow people to say, do we really consider this word this way? I'm hearing mixed things. So let's do a fulsome consultation and get it right.
Councillor Ridge and Councillor Brandon Tozzo, who seconded the motion, found this strayed too far from the original intention to move forward with the name change.
The amendment is contrary to the intention of the motion, which is to begin the renaming process. This is to change that to considering renaming. One may argue that actually could be called out of order, but I'm not going to do that.
I think this runs extremely contrary to that motion, and I think we kind of have to make a decision whether we want to go forward with this or whether we don't. And if we don't want to go forward with renaming the road, I think the option is just to vote it down. So I'm going to vote down this amendment.
The amendment was ultimately voted down, and the decision on whether to rename the road or leave it be was before council. Councillors McLaren and Glenn both agreed that satisfactory consensus has yet to be reached.
The answers that we're going to get have already been selected. It doesn't matter what Indigenous people now say. It doesn't matter what the residents now say. The motion has presumed that there's going to be a name change. And that is paternalistic.
It's a matter of how we go about doing this. And we have to consider the how as much as we consider the what. And maybe this is where this wasn't where we should have been. Maybe we should have had other conversations about it before the motion got to the floor. Maybe there should have been a broader bit of conversation between all of us about what this actually means. I actually think the likely outcome in the long run will be probably a name change, but one that the community will agree with. And consensus building matters in these situations. And I don't think that we're going to build consensus this way. I'm concerned, actually, that we might pit people against one another. So I think I'm going to vote against this motion on that basis alone, that if this how was different, I would have been able to support this.
However, Councillors Tozzo and Vincent Chinnani stressed the need to move forward.
There is a saying by an abolitionist that I rather like, that history, the arc of history is long and it bends towards justice. That's quite optimistic. I don't know if that's always true, because I think it needs to be nudged every now and again. And I think sometimes as political leaders, we have to take that risk and nudge it along the way and try to do the right thing and have some form of justice, however that may be.
So I am going to vote in favor of this, because I think it's important to right wrongs that were done in the past. Even though the intent was good, it feels like in today's society, you have to make that change to move forward, and then so people can feel like they heal. I've talked to a lot of people, and this is a very derogatory word, and there was people surprised that this is even the name of a street here.
Ridge capped off the discussion reading a letter from a resident of Indian Road.
I am not a cancel culture person, and I am not saying that we need to pretend the word Indian doesn't exist. But what I do believe is that having a street in your city named after a word that has come to have derogatory connotation for most people is not a way to commemorate Indigenous history or celebrate current Indigenous communities. I fully support changing the name to something beautiful that has accurate historical and current meanings. I think what most residents are wary of are the administrative hurdles of changing everything related to your address. The city needs to walk residents through this and make it as streamlined and easy as possible. But inconvenience should not be a reason to keep the current name. I really see this as a microcosm of reconciliation in general. We should not be held back because the task seems too expensive or complicated. I love our street. It is home to wonderful people. I want a name that reflects this.
In the end, council voted 7-3 to rename the road. City staff will begin the consultation process for choosing a new name and report back by mid-2026. Council has approved the development of a new special constable appointment strategy aimed at strengthening the city's response to public safety issues and enforcement challenges. Council gave the green light at their June 17th meeting to move forward with a plan that will see 5 existing senior bylaw officers appointed as special constables. These officers would be granted limited police powers under select provincial laws, including the Trespass to Property Act, the Liquor License and Control Act, and the Safe Streets Act, to intervene in high-risk situations when police are unable to. A staff report to council cited increasing pressures in areas like encampment enforcement, large unsanctioned gatherings, and disorderly behavior on city property as the rationale for this move. These situations, often labeled high risk, frequently require immediate intervention, something current enforcement staff can't always manage without timely police support. The report emphasized that despite ongoing cooperation from Kingston Police, limited resources often result in consistent delays. Deputy Police Chief Scott Gee addressed council before the vote.
I know there's somebody in this room that knows somebody, or you've called yourself, that police have been delayed getting there, and that's a reality. When I look at our board at some of our peak times, there can be 17 calls sitting there waiting for police to respond to. And those are generally level 3 and 4, priority 3 and 4 calls. And but to that person calling, it's a priority 1. Right, they expect police to be present, or law enforcement, or the appropriate agencies to be present. So, I think this gives a little bit of an expansion for bylaw to attend and really attend some of those calls on city property, nuisance calls, noise complaints, unwanted persons, maybe targeting areas such as the downtown core. When I say targeting, I mean putting their resources down here. And it really falls down to the Trespass to Property Act and really expanding their roles for the Trespass to Property Act and how that may look. I think the future could be, this could be a strong position. Most universities and, like I said, most other municipalities like Toronto Housing, OC Transpo, they employ a large cadre of special constables because, you know, obviously the cost of a special constable is lower, and the duties they're doing, they've, a lot of services have tried to use private security companies, and it just hasn't been a success. And if you have your staff that are trained, invested, and stay with you, hopefully you put out a better product than a contract.
Kyle Campo, the city's manager of licensing and enforcement, underscored the need for additional tools for bylaw officers in the field.
It's not that we're going to get into these high-risk situations. We are already in them. We are well over 300 calls for encampments on a reactive high-risk scenario. We're not just focused on encampments. There's other aspects for public spaces that we're looking at where we are currently doing these duties where there are safety risks involved with them. I do feel comfortable with this program that it's going to allow my staff the training, the abilities, to look at other aspects that helps protect them and myself and all of the city in terms of, I guess, the liabilities that we're already doing. It's not that, again, we're going into these high-risk scenarios. We are in these high-risk scenarios as we're speaking. So it does give me a level of comfort that there's regulations that governs this. There's going to be reporting mechanisms, but there's also the advanced training. Again, this is not to come out and be forceful in any aspect. This is to protect ourselves.
While the report and proponents state this is a step towards improving community safety, concerns have been expressed by the community regarding over-policing and the impact this could have on vulnerable populations, including unhoused residents and students. Eldira Balaj and Elisa Parisa, representing the Alma Mater Society, a student association at Queen's University, brought student concerns directly to council.
Students and community members have already expressed concerns about the rising criminalization of poverty, housing insecurity, and public gathering. This model raises concerns about how it may be used to police unhoused individuals and police peaceful protesters. Authorizing senior enforcement officials to exercise police-like powers without the full accountability structures, proactive communication lines, extensive training, and community oversight that apply to sworn police officers creates a dangerous ambiguity to authority and escalation. According to our data, in 2024-2025 school year, there were 0 arrests during our UDSI periods like Homecoming, FOCO, St. Patrick's Day, and Orientation Week. Yes, 0. That didn't happen because we had more enforcement. This happened because we practiced proactive collaboration between the AMS, city staff, Queens administration, bylaw officers, police liaison officers. We built trust-based campaigns that worked.
Taking all our concerns into account, we urge council to pause this recommendation, conduct meaningful public consultation with affected communities, including students, advocacy organizations, and equity-deserving groups, and finally, consider reinvesting in harm reduction approaches and civilian-led community safety programs instead of further entrenching enforcement models. As this recommendation stands, this does not seem like a step towards safety. It's a step towards over-policing. This model could potentially show distrust towards your student population, ultimately producing the opposite of the intended effect.
Relaying the concerns from community members, questions from council mainly revolved around oversight and accountability. In response, amendments were introduced by Councillors Brandon Tozzo and Connie Glenn. Tozzo called for a report by the end of 2025 detailing the governance and enforcement framework the special constables will follow. And Glenn added a clause to ensure any expansion of the program will have to come through council again. With these amendments in place, most councillors were ready to cautiously move forward with the program. Councillors Tozzo and Glenn stated the following.
Some of the points that have been risen about this issue in the community, I think, are well taken. We're not, as the chief of police once said, we're not going to police our way out of a mental health and addiction crisis. And we're not. Like, this is a tool, I think, in our toolbox that we do need to look at and take seriously. There have been times I've called bylaw in dealing with challenges in my area, and I know that they would appreciate support for X powers. And I've had constituents who called the police and had to wait out quite a length of time to deal with their issues. The delegation said it best. It's like, even if you're calling the police, it's a priority one to you. If this gives us more tools to deal with some of the challenges that we're facing as a municipality, I support it. But knowing full well that I want to know what we're getting into before this program is launched.
I was tentative about this when it came forward. And I'm still going to remain cautious, but we've put in place, I think, some solid reporting mechanisms, some double checks. One of the things that I wanted to put out there is that I have had contact from a number of members of the community who were concerned about the impact of this on the unhoused and on the encampment community. Now, once they were informed that this would be senior management from bylaw, they were comforted. And I think that this is quite a compliment to our bylaw team that they felt they were capable of doing this and doing this with discretion and with care. So based on that kind of feedback and positive response, I'm heartened to hear that the community is also supportive of this because it's going to be done well. And I trust staff to do that, but I also think we've put the correct mechanisms in place at this point in time. Council has always has the discretion to change their mind on these things, so I'm willing to see this move forward for the time being with the checkback process that it's now being put in place.
Compo also addressed the concern of increased enforcement, stressing that the program will not just be a matter of additional force.
We are always leading by being transparent, working with the community. I appreciate Councillor Glenn's comments in terms of the folks that are reaching out in terms of the encampments, because we really pride ourselves on those relationships that we're building. It's one of the key foundations that, you know, there's a lot of burnout with these types of situations. There's a lot of reoccurring conversations that we have, and we pride ourselves, and that's not going away. We're continuing to build those relationships, not with just members of the vulnerable sector, with the students, with the community in general. That's first and foremost. But I do feel comfort in the fact that we're going to be given the proper tools to be able to deal with these situations that we're already currently dealing with. We're going to be, again, focusing on getting people the proper solutions we need. And then, again, this is only for risk situations that happen when absolutely needed. This is not going out and using any kind of use of force or escalated training or tools in these situations. This is for equipping our staff with the right resources.
Despite reassurance, Councillor Jeff McLaren was the sole vote against the plan, citing concerns about both effectiveness and costs.
One of the things that I learned very quickly coming onto this council was that the Get Tough program is not necessarily the best way to do things. We're on the wrong trajectory when we talk about increasing numbers of police, budgets of police, when we should be talking about what is most beneficial for increasing the trust of those students, of those in the homeless encampments, of people on the streets, in order to get compliance and buy-in. Not just because somebody has a heavy stick or the threat of detainment or extra violence, but because they recognize it as best based on the relationships that people are creating. So I'm going to have to vote against this. It is not sustainable intellectually or from a budget perspective, I believe. Yes, we can handle it this year, maybe even next year, but it's going to become more and more expensive, and I think that money can be better used somewhere else. I believe that it's trust that we need to start developing and finding strategies for, rather than from better enforcement.
The report acknowledged potential financial impacts, including equipment, training, and possible compensation changes, but stated the program will fit within the existing 2025 budget. The motion passed 9-1, McLaren opposed. City staff will now develop a detailed implementation plan outlining training, governance, and reporting requirements. Special constables are expected to be in place by the end of the year. Before we get into more local news, I'm going to turn to our weather and traffic report today, featuring CFRC's Jesse Bell.
This is your City of Kingston traffic report for the week. The LaSalle Causeway's summer and fall closure schedule has been updated by Public Services and Procurement Canada. Reminder that the summer dates of the LaSalle Causeway's closure are as follows: July 1st, 6th, 13th, 20th, and 27th, August 3rd, 10th, 17th, 24th and 31st, and September 7th, the causeway will be closed from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. on each of those summer dates. As for the fall, the current dates are September 21st, October 5th, 14th, and 19th, and November 2nd and 16th, the time of closure being 6 a.m. to 8 p.m. on each of those dates. Here are this week's relevant road closures. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Aberdeen Street, William to Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Berry Street, Queen to Colborn is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. And Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Here are some ongoing delays to be aware of. Abbeydon Road, middle to Highway 2, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Bayridge Drive, Milford to Henderson, expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Collins Bay Road, Woodbine to Princess, expect delays while a contractor completes landscaping work on Collins Bay Road. Florida Road, Henderson to Wilton, expect delays while the contractor is completing work on the annual surface treatment contract. Front Road, Sand Bay to Country Club, expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Gardner's Road at Centennial and Creekford, expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence, expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle, expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead structure. Montreal Street at John Counter, expect delays for upgrades to the intersection including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users and to accommodate increased traffic from the Wabin Crossing. Victoria Street and Earl Street, expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction for sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
This is the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Beginning with Monday, June 23rd, we're going to see a daytime high of 26, but it'll feel closer to 32. As such, a heat warning has been put in place for Kingston and the surrounding area. That will continue into Tuesday, June 24th, daytime high of 29, feeling closer to 35 out in the sun. So take your time, take it easy, and stay cool. Wednesday, June 25th, it cools off ever so slightly, daytime high of 26 with cloudy conditions. And moving into Thursday, June 26th, we have a daytime high of 23, but a 60% chance of precipitation, which is expected to cool conditions slightly here in the city of Kingston. That rain will give way to thunderstorms on Friday, June 27th. Same daytime high of 23 degrees, but a 70% chance of precipitation and thunderstorms into the afternoon. We're going to see a potential for thunderstorms on Saturday, June 28th, same daytime high of 23, and about a 60% chance of storms throughout the day. Moving towards the end of the weekend, Sunday, June 29th, conditions warm up slightly, going back to 25 degrees, and we're going to see a lot of cloud cover here in the city of Kingston. And then moving into the start of next week, Monday, June 30th, daytime high of 24 degrees with a 70% chance of precipitation.
Thank you, Jesse. Now back to more local news. In an effort to spark youth participation, the Kingston Fall Fair is bringing back the Ambassador Competition this year, inviting Kingston and Frontenac residents ages 17 to 24 to compete for the title and represent the fair. Each fall, the fair showcases local agriculture in the heart of the city, celebrating the region's farming sector and community spirit. The 193rd edition of the Fall Fair will be taking place this September at the Memorial Center, organized by the Kingston and District Agricultural Society, which is celebrating its 200th anniversary in 2025. The Vice President of the Kingston and District Agricultural Society, Heather Ambrose, who has been involved with the fair for just over 30 years, spoke a bit to the history of the Ambassador Program.
So the history of the Fall Ambassador has been around. We had it a long time ago, and I believe it was actually like the Queen of the Fair or something like that. And this was talking way, way many years ago now. So a lot of the towns around us also participated. Napanee is actually bringing back their ambassador program as well this year. So it's exciting for the growth of the program too. And just bringing, I think it's the same thing though, just trying to bring the youth in and figuring out the best way to reach them.
The idea to revive the program came from a young person on the committee aiming to engage more youth.
So we actually recruited this wonderful, young, enthusiastic lady who has been part of the ambassador program in her youth. And she really wanted to bring it back to our fairgrounds. So we did a little test run last year where we had her talking to just people that were attending the fair and that, and to see what kind of interest there was. And then it's just kind of grown from there. So we're super excited to have someone to lead. Like, the fair is run all by volunteers. So having someone to take on such a big project has been like, been wonderful. And then it's more so like it just promotes our fair and agricultural and what we do and what the farmers do too, for that matter, with a group that we're missing at like a 17 to 24 year old. So we're really trying to target that group of people and how we can get them more involved. And this was a great way to start.
As Ambrose mentioned, participation in this specific age group has been difficult to achieve, especially in recent years.
Other than needing high school volunteer hours, it is hard to get youth involved. It's easy to get the kids. It's easy to pique their interest and get them to come out. But even for things like the, just to change different things that we do, like the country singing showdown, trying to get that youth group out again, it's hard. We always get like we'll get the littles, and then we'll get like a couple teenagers that are in there, and then a lot of open category. But it's just hard to get them to come out of that shell and like be part of something different and volunteering and getting out there, whether it's through the ambassador program, 4-H, or whatever it is.
Is this kind of a new development, or has it always kind of been this way where that age group is a little tricky?
I think it's something that we've just noticed over the past couple of years, you know, especially since COVID. Like, when we came back from COVID, there was obviously like a mad rush at the fairgrounds when we were there. We had over 30,000 people come through our gates. But since then, it's like trying to get more of our youth involved in the volunteering aspect of it, just because they enjoy it and because they want to be part of it, that's where it's difficult. So trying to get them to come and be part, even the ambassador program, we're hoping that the ambassador being in that age category will help us as a board find ways to get more youth involved so we can appeal to them and do things that they would like to.
Beyond the fair, a lack of youth in the agricultural sector has been a growing concern. According to 2021 data from Statistics Canada, the average age of Canadian farmers is 56, and just 8.6% of Canadian farmers are 35 and younger.
In general, in some of the working trades, whether it's agricultural or just like construction, for example, there is a lack of people interested in that.
The Ambassador Program aims to help bridge the gap by getting youth involved now and helping to ensure the fair's future for generations to come.
As a fair board member, we need youth so that we can keep promoting it for the youth and keeping them interested and keeping and finding out how to reach them so that they get involved as volunteers in our community as well. So keeping volunteers, like all of our volunteer boards, myself would be one of the younger ones. And I mean, I'm not young, I'm 45. So it's like, how do you get more people involved? And we just try to keep, without the volunteers, we can't have these programs and we can't run the fall fair and stuff like that. So it's so important. Like, we're hoping that by doing the ambassador program, that'll help us bridge that gap. Maybe we can get more volunteers coming and stuff like, or maybe the ambassador will continue to be a volunteer throughout the years as they keep going, you know, throughout whatever they're doing in their life kind of thing.
Alongside encouraging youth participation, Ambrose hopes the program could be an enriching experience for the ambassador. One that offers insight on the local agricultural sector, growth, and community connection.
I think it just brings awareness to what agricultural actually does for, and what like the farming community does for our community alone. It's a leadership for whoever it is that comes through and gets the ambassador thing. They'll be involved at the fair. They'll be involved in our board meetings. They'll be involved in the, we attend a convention every year with a bunch of other Ontario agricultural societies where the ambassador will be represented there from Kingston. The Kingston Fall Fair ambassador will be represented there. And it's just like, it's a big opportunity for the individual's growth, really. And it'll be a good opportunity for them to get out there and just be part of the community.
The winner will present awards at various competitions during the fair and attend other events throughout the year, including the three-day Ontario Association of Agricultural Societies convention in Richmond Hill in February, and, if desired, the Canadian National Exhibition in Toronto next summer. The winner will also be awarded an $800 cash prize plus a clothing allowance. Application details are available at kingstonfair.com, and submissions will be accepted until July 31st. We have a few messages directly from the City of Kingston this morning. To start us off, music, food, fireworks, and fun, the City of Kingston invites you to a spectacular Canada Day celebration. On Tuesday, July 1st, gather downtown in Confederation Park in Springer Market Square to celebrate Canada Day with the City of Kingston. This year's free and family-friendly celebration features the Kids Zone sponsored by Canada Royal Milk, live music, food trucks, and will end with a fireworks show above Lake Ontario sponsored by the Island Queen. Other attractions throughout the day include cultural activities, performances, face painting, vendors, and more. Additionally, Kingston Public Market vendors will set up in Springer Market Square all day. Megan Surrett, Manager of Events and Programs at the City of Kingston, states, quote, Canada Day is a fantastic opportunity for a community to come together, reflect on shared values, and showcase the vibrant spirit that makes our city and our country so special. Whether you're a Kingston resident or visiting for the first time, this is the perfect opportunity to enjoy the city's vibrant culture, connect with your community, and make unforgettable memories. Special thanks to our sponsors, the Island Queen and Canada Royal Milk, for their wonderful support at this year's event, end quote. Once again, this will be at Confederation Park and Springer Market Square, 216 Ontario Street, on Tuesday, July 1st, from noon to 10 p.m. In another message directly from the city, construction begins this week on new National Memorial to the Fallen in McDonald Park. Construction has begun this week on the National Memorial to the Fallen in McDonald Park, with crews setting up on Tuesday, June 17th, and initial excavation starting on Wednesday, June 18th. The wall is a partnership between the National Wall of Remembrance Association and the City of Kingston, dedicated to honoring all Canadian veterans who lost their lives during military conflicts. Bruce Ewing, Vice Chair of NWORA, states, quote, After almost 15 years of fundraising and planning, the National Wall of Remembrance Association is starting construction on the National Memorial to the Fallen with an unveiling to take place in September 2025. This memorial is in honor of the more than 120,000 Canadians killed in service to Canada. In 2019, the National Wall of Remembrance Association approached the City of Kingston with a proposal to create a single place of remembrance for all of Canada's fallen heroes. In July 2019, City Council directed staff to work with the NWORA to develop a plan for the memorial. Council approved the plan in December 2022, and an official sod-turning ceremony took place in August 2023. Since then, staff from numerous city departments have worked with the NWORA to advance the project. On-site activities have included an archaeological assessment, environment soil testing, and the protection of trees, as well as the necessary removal of a small number of trees to accommodate the memorial. Following city policy, these trees will be replaced at another location in the future. Staff and the NWORA project committee considered several city-owned locations for this project and agreed that the eastern portion of McDonald Park was the most suitable site. McDonald Park, located in the Old Sydenham Heritage Conservation District, is a site rich in local and national history, especially pertaining to military uses and commemorations. The monument will be formally transferred to the city upon completion of construction. Funding will be provided by the NWORA to support the ongoing care and maintenance as part of the City of Kingston's civic collection. Completion of the memorial is scheduled for late summer 2025. Local Arts Residency Program returns with four residencies this July. The Baby Grand at Kingston Grand Theatre will once again be hosting four unique and creative artistic endeavors as the City of Kingston's Local Arts Residency Program is set to take over this July. Now in its fifth year, the residency program supports local artists by providing professional space, technical resources, and creative freedom to develop new work in the heart of downtown Kingston. Jason Duggan, performing arts manager at the City of Kingston, states, quote, "The local arts residency is a vital part of the city's commitment to supporting Kingston's arts community. We're proud to continue investing in programs that empower artists to create, connect, and inspire," end quote. Following an open call for applications, four projects were selected by a jury composed of past residency participants. The 2025 Artists-in-Residence are Kira Flavin with Ground Up Dance Festival, Katie Legere with Chris Alfano and William Egnatov, Jarena Lee and Sarah Mergani, and Nathan Z and Calvin Chun. Launched in 2021 in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Local Arts Residency is managed by the city's Arts and Culture Services Department, which also operates the Kingston Grand Theatre and produces the Grand On Stage program. The residency offers artists access to the Baby Grand's state-of-art facilities, technical production support, and a $1,000 honorarium. Stay tuned to the city's social media channels and the City of Kingston website for more information about the local arts residency. Videos of past artists in residence can be found on the Kingston Grand Theatre's YouTube channel. Once again, that was just a few messages directly from the City of Kingston. That is all things current in Kingston for this week. Thank you for listening to CFRC's local news programming, brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. To listen on the go and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Be sure to stay tuned for CFRC's afternoon lineup.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.